You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 29th of November 2021 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily is brought to you in association with Allianz.
COVID-19 continues to find new ways to be profoundly tedious, censorship and self-censorship in China, and a destination gets chalked off the next royal tour. I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily in association with Allianz starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests, Mary Dejewski and Jonathan Fenby, will discuss all the day's big stories, and we'll hear from Hong Kong, whose people are being increasingly terrorised by feral hogs. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily in association with Allianz on Monocle 24. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I'm joined today by Mary Dejewski, foreign affairs commentator and columnist for The Independent, and by Jonathan Fenby, author and former editor of newspapers in the UK and Asia. Hello to you both.
Hello.
By way of cunningly foreshadowing one of our later items, I did want to ask you both what's the longest you've ever actually been stuck somewhere by forces beyond your control. I will open the bidding, Jonathan, with I think it was 3 days in O'Hare Airport in Chicago due to storms. It might just have seemed like 3 days. And there was about another 3 days extra in Gaza when somebody tried to blow up the Erez crossing and therefore I couldn't get out.
I can have two days in O'Hare too, where a place where people always seem to get stuck. But I can trump you most certainly with 10 days, 2 weeks, was it, stuck with the American Navy, who had, God, this is a very, very long story. When I was a correspondent in Vietnam, they flew me to the Philippines by mistake. And they couldn't send me back to Saigon because there was some kind of in-out visa row going on with Manila, the Philippines, and I was stuck in an American Navy and then Air Force base, Subic Bay and Clark Field. And for much of the time, I was stuck with a whiskey swilling Catholic priest in his underwear who tried to convert me.
To what?
Well, whatever his religion was. That's been blanked out of my memory, but that was the longest time, and I couldn't get away. I was a national security risk.
Then as now. Mary, Jonathan has raised the bar to a formidable height.
He has, and I don't think I can reach it, but by proxy, I will claim for my sister, who was stuck with me for 3 weeks in the UK because of the Icelandic volcano. And I will also, I think, gain the exotic card by being stuck in Vladivostok for nearly a week waiting for flying weather to get to Sakhalin.
Okay, well, it could all be worse for the people we will be discussing later in the show, is what we've just learned there. But we will begin with the world's ongoing and reluctant education in the Greek alphabet. Omicron, a new variant of COVID-19, has been classed as a variant of concern by the World Health Organization, and governments around the world are indeed variably concerned. The UK, for one, has reinstated compulsory masks in shops and on public transport and resurrected its so-called red travel list, severely curtailing travel from 10 countries in southern Africa. However, reports suggest that Omicron is well and truly on the march, with cases detected as far afield as Australia, Israel and Denmark. Mary, first of all, South Africa's health minister has said there's no need to panic. Is he being listened to, do you think?
Well, I don't think he is being listened to, partly because I think there is, and South Africa is right to a degree that it has been sort of stigmatized because of the whole sort of international competition thing over treatment and survival rates for various variants of this virus. But at the same time, you do sort of hope that they're right, because maybe one of the reasons why so many cases are currently coming to light all over the world is that the effects actually, you know, fingers crossed, let's hope for the best, maybe the actual symptoms and the actual experience of this variant of the disease is nothing like as bad as the others. And if that turns out to be true, then, you know, South Africans are right.
That is, Jonathan, of course, the optimistic analysis of Omicron, which I have read from a few cautiously optimistic actual experts in this field, that maybe this is getting towards what I think is what we can best realistically hope COVID-19 becomes, which is a bit of a seasonal nuisance.
Seasonal nuisance. And also, I mean, the really optimistic seem to say that this could wipe out the Delta. I'm not quite sure how this exactly works, but this could supplant the Delta and will be less serious, much milder, and it becomes like, you know, got a bad touch of the flu.
Which would be, grand scheme of things, delightful of the available options. Obviously, we can't be absolutely certain that's what this is going to prove to be. That being the case, Jonathan, and it is... Obviously, governments around the world have made mistakes all along, but I think we do always have to remember that this is something you do have to react to as it goes along. That being the case, if we look at the UK and what is being introduced, or rather reintroduced, and I think we should probably say reintroduced in England as opposed to the UK, because Scotland and Wales have not abandoned as many of those restrictions. Do you think those are sensible precautions at this point?
I think they are, and they're probably not enough, in fact. I mean, still, you know, coming down to your studio on the bus this evening, there were a lot of people who weren't wearing masks. You see very few people. The awareness needs to be raised, I think, very considerably.
Mary, what do you think? Because, again, the government has now had, a government here, that is, has now had 18 months and change to actually figure out how to get better at messaging during a public health crisis. They were terrible at it at the start. Do you get the impression they're improving?
Well, I get the impression that one of the reasons they're treating the current variant in the way they are is because they want to show that they learnt from all the criticism last time around. And there were two lots of criticisms. One of them was that they hadn't acted early enough for the first wave. And the second was that when the variant that became associated with India, which I think then became called the Delta variant, that they didn't shut down. They left it for weeks and left the flights coming in and people going unchecked. And there was a lot of criticism about that.
Jonathan, there is a suggestion, and again, this may be the optimistic one, that this may end up being less bad for the United Kingdom on the basis that due to, you know, whether by design or lackadaisy, the UK has already absorbed the wave, which is now striking Europe.
Yes, and that vaccination rates are sufficiently high. But of course, you know, it's a matter of concern, this, because of all the uncertainties which we still have. And we're told it'll be a couple of weeks before those answers are found to those. And one is, obviously, whether the vaccinations that we've had so far are actually a defence against this new strain.
Mary, just finally on this, there is a point of linguistic nicety that we do need to consider. And you are the resident Greek scholar at this table. It is indeed, listeners, to Mary whom I owe everything I have learned about the pronunciation of Omicron. So if I have, in fact, got that wrong, complain to Mary, not me. I'm just doing what I'm told. But there is, of course, a decision that has had to be made, Mary, about skipping a couple of letters of the Greek alphabet.
Yes, this is a very exciting story, and it's been all over Twitter all weekend, with people posting very pretty versions of the Greek alphabet and pointing out that there must have been half a day when the new variant was described as the new variant.
You can see how that would confuse people.
where, of course, it related to the Greek letter. And here I refer to my classical Greek O level, courtesy of Sheffield Girls High School, a very long time ago. But after new comes a very curly, squiggly sort of letter, which is Xi, or at least we were taught that it was Xi. But the thing is that when it comes out in Latin letters, it's Xi. And of course, Xi has certain resonance for a certain Chinese leader, Xi Jinping. And so miraculously, and somehow sort of on the quiet, that letter was sort of forgotten about. And we went went directly on to...
But China has a famously thick skin and never gets upset about anything.
Of course not.
An observation which does rather neatly cue up our next item, because it is not news that for a colossal, undefiable military and economic superpower which is home to a fifth of humanity, China is remarkably sensitive towards the mildest of slights. Accordingly, those who bring their wares to market in China tend to err on the side of tiptoeing through a minefield of trigger points. It is news, then, that Disney streaming service Disney Plus has launched in Hong Kong minus episode 12 of series 16 of The Simpsons, in which the titular family visit Beijing, noting a sign at Tiananmen Square reading, "On this site in 1989, nothing happened." Jonathan, my willfully ingenuous question here, or disingenuous, I always forget which is which, shouldn't China be pleased with that? I mean, that's the party line.
Yes, but I think they realise that I think somebody in the Politburo knows The Simpsons are not a straight, you know, it's not as straight a delivery as they would wish, and so on. And what you said earlier is definitely so, that companies are just scared stiff of advertently or inadvertently, and the second is worse for them in a sense, giving offence to the great opaque leadership in Beijing, which doesn't say much, but acts.
I am reminded at this point that I once was shoehorned onto a group tour of Tiananmen Square in Beijing, and I will confess that quite a few of the attendees on that tour every so often kept asking the guide, "Didn't something happen here in 1989 that was in all the papers?" She got very, very, very tired of us very quickly. Mary, this is what I always end up thinking about things like this, though, that for any country, never mind a superpower of China's heft, this is kind of pathetic, isn't it? I mean, I'm also sitting here speaking as an Australian who, a country which is monstrously mocked in one famous episode of The Simpsons, and I think you would really have to go a long way to find the Australian who was other than delighted by it, frankly.
Well, I mean, I wonder whether Disney isn't maybe being a bit too defensive here. But there was another aspect of this particular episode that I was reading about that seemed to me might be just as sensitive for the Chinese as Tiananmen Square, which is that apparently the reason for the visit to China was to adopt a Chinese baby.
Mm.
Now, I don't think that, certainly in today's China, that goes down particularly well. And it certainly doesn't go down well in quite a few other countries, such as South Korea or Russia or various places where people from the West generally went to adopt small children. So I wonder whether there wasn't a degree of sensitivity about that as well.
Jonathan, it's not clear, as I understand it, whether this episode has been pulled on the explicit instruction of Beijing or whether Disney Plus have decided to avoid the argument by pulling it themselves. But have we reached the point where China is concerned that censorship and self-censorship are in fact more or less the same thing? Because eventually this is how censorship and suppression works. You don't have to do it yourself. People will do it for you to avoid the argument.
What used to be known when I was in Hong Kong as the preemptive kowtow. You know, you do it and just hope you're doing the right thing and getting out of trouble. Of course, it doesn't always work, because sometimes the people you're kowtowing to actually don't want you to kowtow to them particularly. It doesn't fit their agenda, so on. And I've found that several times. Not that I ever preemptively kowtowed.
Of course not.
No. But it is very difficult. And I think this is going to get more and more difficult for American companies in particular, Western companies in general, dealing with China, because they're there. They love the Chinese market. They want to get into the Chinese market. It'll be a considerable source of revenue and profit, but they never know when they're putting a foot wrong. And this can be over something like The Simpsons there. It can be because you've got into bed with the wrong Chinese partner, as it were, in a business sense, of course, and that partner has fallen foul politically of the powers that be. This is a minefield, but it's one that a lot of foreign companies obviously regard as just too profitable to pass by.
Mary, I often wonder if some sort of index could be calculated about tracking a country's path to or away from democracy versus its sense of humour about its history and itself, because it is a condition of tyrannies, isn't it, that they are all entirely humourless.
Well, it is on the surface and at the top and officially, but some of the most, if you like, effective, cruel dictatorships then spawn a sort of underground in satire and jokes. And certainly, you know, when I was in Russia as a student in the 70s, when I was there as it was opening up in the late 80s, spectacularly brilliant jokes about the communist regime that were exchanged in private, but everybody knew them. And the same with sort of, you know, things that people would sketch and draw and show people.
I think what is particularly striking in this case is that it has happened in Hong Kong. This has been reported from Hong Kong, where, of course, the government, local government, follows what Beijing does or tries to anticipate what Beijing may want. And I was in Hong Kong now, it's a long time ago, two decades ago and so on, but this kind of censorship would have been unthinkable then, and it is a kind of register of how things have moved. And in lots of other ways, Hong Kong has become much, much more censored, and people thinking, I just don't want to get on the wrong side of Beijing and so on. But what Mary says is completely true, and that was the case in China itself for a period under Hu Jintao. Certainly that there was a kind of satire coming up, even stand-up comics, one of whom imitated the Prime Minister famously. But you're not going to get any of that now.
Jonathan Fenby and Mary Jeske, thank you both for the moment. You're listening to The Monocle Daily. We will have more from our panel right after this.
For more than 130 years, Allianz has expanded its business and stretched its brand in new and innovative ways. And while the world looks very different today than it did back in 1890, one truth remains. Allianz's passion for securing people's lives and giving them courage for what's ahead, no matter what. The world is a better place when people have more courage than fear. Especially in uncertain times, people seek stability and confidence. Today, we're putting the future of mobility firmly in the spotlight. With waves of innovation, a rapid evolution in tech and industry, and a new era of service upon us, it's an area ripe with both challenge and potential opportunity. Thomas Kunzmann, CEO Mobility and Assistance at Allianz Partners, is here to talk about the meaning and future of mobility. Thomas, welcome. What kind of insurance products are you offering in terms of new or newer mobility solutions, shared mobility and so on?
If we look into shared mobility, we offer there from a pure insurance perspective everything you can imagine. So for instance, micromobility. I'm sure you used as well a few of the e-scooters. So we as Allianz Partners have insured Lime in more than 22 countries. And we ensured that this is not just a pure liability coverage, but as well it goes beyond and it goes into the direction of creating the peace of mind for our customers. So if you jump on that line, you don't have to bother if you're protected or not. And that is something that is driving us as well into the new areas. New areas would be in that car sharing area or new mobility solutions, as well car subscriptions. So even already today, if you are a German customer, you can buy a new Volvo. You buy your new Volvo, by the way, fully digital if you want to, because we have adapted as well to COVID and OEMs did as well. And at the end, you can decide if you buy that car as a one-off or you want to subscribe on a monthly level. And that subscription includes completely all our services, including insurance, including assistance services if you have a breakdown. And it really gives you the full, what we call, peace of mind.
Thomas Kunzmann, CEO Mobility and Assistance at Allianz Partners, talking about the future of mobility. More ways in which you can unlock, build and maintain confidence today and tomorrow with Allianz. Allianz, behind you for what's ahead.
Welcome back to the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller. Still with me are our guests, Mary Dejewski and Jonathan Fenby. As of tomorrow, the number of countries of which Queen Elizabeth II is head of state will decrease from 16 to 15. Barbados will become a republic at a ceremony attended by Prince Charles, which is sporting of him. It is the realisation of an ambition harboured for some while by Barbadian Prime Minister Mia Mottley, and what now remains to be seen is whether it gives the rest of the Caribbean region ideas. Of the 15 remaining Commonwealth realms, 8 are more or less in that vicinity. Mary, name them. No, don't do that.
Thank you. Do you think you've got time?
Do you think, though, that other dominoes may now topple? It isn't that simple. I have written a thing about this for the next edition of Monocle magazine, researching which I learned that other countries, many other countries in the region, would require a referendum, which Barbados does not, and that's obviously a bit more of a thing. But do you think Barbados is going to be the last to leave?
I doubt that it will be the last to leave, because I think that it might, that other countries in the region, seeing what's happened and seeing the sort of, you know, I think it confers a sort of sense of national identity and dignity and in internationally that people will find quite attractive. So I think whether you have to have a referendum or not, I think that more could follow.
Is this now one-way traffic, Jonathan? I don't know how this works. I don't know if you can still apply to the United Kingdom to adopt Queen Elizabeth II as your head of state. But
imagine a republic somewhere saying we want the Queen as head of state.
That is hard to imagine. But that number of 15 remaining Commonwealth realms, it's not going to go up, is it?
No, it doesn't. And indeed, you know, some other, I think Jamaica may follow suit very soon. And,
of their own accord.
Yes. And don't get into that. Several other Caribbean countries have already done so. But what is striking is, as you said in the intro, Prince Charles goes there and is making what I'm sure is an suitably emollient speech and so on about how we're all together in a great brotherhood or sisterhood under the Commonwealth, etc. And all this is treated, it isn't revolutionary. This isn't, you know, cutting off the sovereign's head and declaring a republic. This is rather gentle politics, I think.
An update from the production booth is that the Jamaican Prime Minister, Andrew Holness, has announced that Jamaica's constitution will undergo a major review next year, possibly.
I was at least 20 seconds ahead.
Well, indeed, possibly with some seditious impulse animating it. But while there are fewer and fewer Commonwealth realms, Mary, weirdly, the Commonwealth has expanded, and since 1995 at least, Rwanda and Mozambique have joined it, despite neither having any particular ties to the British Empire. So does the Commonwealth still actually matter?
Well, I think that Brexit Britain and Global Britain as the manifestation of the UK after Brexit did rather fancy the idea that the Commonwealth would become a sort of, not exactly a replacement, but it would give Britain an international standing and international status around the world, and it would give it a sort of a lot of sort of informal allies that would enhance Britain's prestige in the world. I'm not sure how realistic that is, because, you know, if you go into the small print of the Commonwealth, you find that there's quite a lot of divisions and disagreements. And a few years ago, there was a huge fuss about Zimbabwe, which divided the Commonwealth, provided a huge scandal. So I'm not sure that all is well with as well with the Commonwealth as maybe it sometimes looks from London. But I've always thought that it's quite interesting that to join the Commonwealth, you don't have to have the Queen as head of state, that the two things are sort of separate. So Barbados stays in the Commonwealth. And that, in a way, has it's meant that, you know, I've got a lot of sympathy for republicanism in, for instance, Australia. I mean, it seems to me, I just doesn't make sense really for Australia.
We have had one go at getting out from under it,
but it didn't happen. And I've never
another?
Quite understood why not.
I think the Republicans, I think, in Australia fumbled the last one by not going along with the idea of a popularly elected head of state. They wanted a very minimal model. It'd be basically the same as what we already have, except the Governor General, though it might now be the President or something, would be appointed by Parliament, etc. My honest hunch now is that I think there's a lot of affection for the current occupant of the throne, and I think that that helped amplify a lot of the pro-monarchy vote as well. I suspect that after a decent interval and during the next Labour government, it might be put to the people again. But having now identified myself as the feral colonial at this table, I will ask you, Jonathan, how far would you go? Would you abolish the monarchy right here in the UK?
If it wasn't so complicated, yes.
It would make Brexit look like something.
I'm instinctively a Republican, but then you think, how do you actually go about it? And given the state of British politics, particularly at the moment, I know you shouldn't judge these great issues by what's happening this week or this month, but given the state of British politics, I can't see a president being elected who would achieve the kind of unanimity and allegiance which a president needs.
I mean, you're available, Jonathan.
Well, I've tried several times. In fact, I've been thinking of setting up an independent republic where in the block of flats we live in, but the other tenants don't seem to be interested.
No, I mean, I'm one thing that crossed my mind, and learning that Prince Charles was actually going to be at the ceremony, which I have to say I was quite surprised about, it did cross my mind, would Prince Charles, as King Charles as he might then be, would he be so amenable to going, say, to preside over a ceremony for the independence of Scotland? Just crosses your mind. No. Because that also creates, if the UK were to break up, that creates a problem as to whether they stay under the monarchy system or whether they become mini-republics.
Well, let us put a lid on that can of worms and move along to our next topic, because however grim your lockdowns have been, or perchance lockdowns still to come, spare a thought for the patrons of the Tanhill Inn in the Yorkshire Dales National Park, who went to see the Oasis tribute band Noasis at the venue on Friday night and are still there, trapped by snow deposited by Storm Arwen, very possibly not the first time the songs of Oasis have been played amid large heaps of white powder, etc. The beleaguered mid-90s rock music aficionados have been passing the time with films, pub quizzes, karaoke, board games, and one hopes but doubts, taking a long, hard look at the life choices that led them to this point. Are either of you massively au fait with the works of Oasis? Because if you're not, then my brilliant, brilliant upcoming joke is going to fall completely flat.
No, I am not.
But I love the name of the tribute band. It's brilliant.
Yes, but I'll laugh anyway.
Okay, good. Because this is very, very good.
And
I
just
assure
make a
signal.
Make a signal.
I assure you this is an extremely good joke, which was, do you think if they ordered soup, they would get a roll with it? There's an Oasis song called "Roll With It." Do you see?
Good.
That was a very, very good joke, and not, as I suspect you both may have believed, a bad one. The question,
now I'm laughing.
Yeah. The question raised, though, or the question we would like to raise, we talked a bit at the top of the show, is where you both have been stuck. Mary, I will ask you first, where would you most like to be stuck? If you had to be stuck somewhere, and I'm assuming it is not up a snow-covered hill in the Yorkshire Dale Dales with an Oasis tribute group. What would you pick?
I would love to be stuck on a cruise liner off Iceland in the summer months where the sun never sets.
That's a nice idea, but the drawback, as I see it, is that there would be other people on the cruise liner, and they might well be the sort of people who go on cruises.
Not on my cruise ship.
Now, be careful. I have been on cruises. And we have a fairly positive view of them in the Fenby household.
Do you? Okay, I will at this point admit that I have been on a cruise, which I did actually quite enjoy. It was a country music cruise. Seven days in the Caribbean out of Miami, listening to Steve Earle and John Prine.
Yeah, well, I was lecturing on a cruise, so I could talk all the time. It was like this panel, but, you know, night and day.
So if you weren't going to pick a cruise, Jonathan, where would you pick?
Well, there's a particular village in the south centre of France. This won't surprise anybody who knows me. Where we go, but we only spend a day or two there, passing through usually. I would quite like to be isolated there for a while by whatever weather might be necessary. And by strange coincidence, the owner of the hotel in this little village, a very good restaurant and hotel, posted a shot today of the village under the snow. But I'm here in London. I'm not there.
See, well, I mean, if I can pick one to bring it back to where we came in, I did actually quite enjoy the wait in O'Hare Airport in Chicago. The storm was spectacular to watch. I will admit that I had a perfectly agreeable hotel room, and some other mug was picking up all the bills.
I thought you were lying on the couches.
That would have been awful and undignified. And, you know, I had plenty to read, and you know, it's America, so people are friendly. You can go out and have a bit of a chat to people in there. Airport bars and stuff, it was all right.
Yeah. But what I would not like, since you haven't asked that yet,
I was going to,
would be to find myself in an isolated country house with a lot of Agatha Christie characters about to kill each other.
See, my answer, Mary, actually is up a hill in the Yorkshire Dales with an Oasis tribute band. So where would you least want to be stuck?
Well, I think I would not want to be stuck with anybody who was busy playing board games, doing karaoke, or charades, especially not charades. And I did say before we actually came on that I would, in that event, I would actually retreat to the barn, and I would be very happy to be consorting with the sheep, who would at least be lovely and warm.
Well, we will move finally on today's show seamlessly along from sheep to pigs. God, that was there was a link there waiting to be made, and I think I just fluffed it massively. That went worse than the whole roll with it joke. But anyway, we are heading to Hong Kong, where the city faces a new-ish threat, wild boars. These creatures usually live in the hills that surround Hong Kong, but for some reason, the porcine population has exploded during the COVID-19 pandemic, and they are now venturing into the city more and more and attacking the citizens thereof. Monocle's Naomi Shu Elegant in Hong Kong sent us this report.
In the early hours of November 10th, a Hong Kong police officer was knocked over and bitten on the leg, waist, and buttock in a dark car park while approaching a suspect. The assailant barreled past the cop to escape and fell off the building, plunging 33 feet to its death. The officer has since recovered, but the incident convinced Hong Kong authorities to implement a controversial campaign to tackle the city's latest threat, wild boars. 1 week after the attack, officers from Hong Kong's Agriculture, Fisheries and Conservation Department launched their first wild pig capture operation. On November 17th, a large group of boars wandered down Shun Wan Road on their nightly stroll to chase cars and search for snacks. The wildlife officers knew they were coming. They lured the unsuspecting pigs closer with bread and then fired tranquilizer dart guns at least seven hogs, knocking them out. But rather than the capture and relocation strategy that the department had been using for years, that night, the officers tried a new tactic, capture and kill. Once the pigs were unconscious, a vet used an injection to put them down, and the officers zipped the bodies into black bags. By 10 p.m. that night, it was done. The incident caused an uproar among animal rights groups and soft-hearted citizens. Since 2017, when the Hong Kong government suspended a program that issued boar hunting licenses to civilians, the city's wild boar population has exploded, and the animals have become a cute and increasingly common sight around Hong Kong, appearing on hiking trails but also riding the subway, crossing busy intersections, and wandering through restricted areas to get onto airport tarmac. In 2020, a sow and her litter of piglets took a dip in the fountain outside the Bank of China in the middle of the financial district. Sadly, public sympathy for the boars has contributed to Hong Kong's hog problem. Many beachgoers and hikers have taken to feeding the boars, who have learned that they can get food from humans and so are venturing more and more into populated urban areas. They have no natural predators, so their numbers multiplied rapidly after the government stopped issuing hunting licenses. The pig population is now so large, an estimated 3,000 pigs, that the previous tactic of relocating or sterilizing captured boars is no longer sufficient. Groups like the SPCA and the Hong Kong Wild Boar Concern Group have criticized the culling campaign, but the government seems intent on following through. The Conservation Department said it will help safeguard public safety and reminded citizens that it's illegal to feed the boars, saying that wild pigs are not pets but potentially dangerous large animals. Not everyone was convinced. A 9-year-old boy wrote a petition to Chief Executive Carrie Lam, asking the government not to kill the boars. Lam didn't respond to the child's plea, but the Conservation Department penned a reply, explaining that the number of wild boar attacks on people has increased in the last few years, and the old capture and relocate tactics weren't working. "We have no choice but to use more assertive actions," the department said, assuring the child that only boars causing nuisances in urban areas would be targeted. Peaceful rural boars should be safe, as long as they don't try taking the train.
That was Monocle's Naomi Hsu, elegant reporting from Hong Kong. That is all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. A big thanks to our panellists today, Mary Dajewski and Jonathan Fenby. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Ribello and researched by Sophie Monaghan-Coombs and Lillian Fawcett. Our sound engineer was Steph Chungu. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.